So here we are then,
12 noon, and Origins of Modern Britain is about to launch. Because we are in the 21st century, and because obviously last time I took you as a group, it was reporting continuity and change in most cases. I think a couple of didn't tell for me last year. I'm going to endeavour to actually make sure that all of the lectures will be available as podcasts. So you don't have to record the actual transcription. I'll make sure that they'll actually be online probably within 2 or 3 days of the actual original delivery, and certainly ahead of the seminar. Quick heads up in terms of the seminars, a little bit of housekeeping. Seminar Group A, you will be with me next Monday between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. in MB 1005. So that's the main building, another building, it's this building, just along the corridor there. And Seminar B, for 1 week only next week, on Wednesdays between 3 and 4, you will be in the University Library 110. So that's over there for the week after we come back here, or to the main building again. That should appear on your timetables, so all should be clear. And the idea is not too dissimilar to what we did within Reporting Continuity and Change, but with a few added examples and more input from your own confident Level 2 selves. We'll be using the seminars to discuss and really put the flesh on the bones of some of the areas I'll be focusing on within the lectures. Okay? So, first bit of interactivity. Could you put your hand up if you can tell me who this individual is?
Yeah? Churchill?
Winston Churchill would be the correct answer. Absolutely. And we start this whole sequence, this introductory section, to consider post-war Britain, because on the one hand, yes, Britain, this plucky island in the North Atlantic, had successfully seen off the threat of invasion from Nazi Germany and was also engaged in global influences and so on. But unfortunately, we were bankrupt. There were a whole range of issues that really make this particular part of the middle of the 20th century a really key, important part to commence our look at the origins of modern Britain. In other words, how have we actually reached the stage that we are now? How have we kind of seen society and our changes emerge to what we experience and perhaps take for granted in this, the second decade of the 20th century? Well, the Second World War, as I mentioned, was very expensive. It was very expensive not just in terms of cash, but also in terms of lives. Over 500,000 people actually died. It was also hugely expensive in terms of creating a huge national debt. And after the war, this country, fit for heroes, continued to live well beyond its means. The infrastructure of Britain had effectively crumbled. Factory equipment was worn out, it was outmoded, and millions of buildings had been destroyed in bombing raids and aspects of war that effectively meant that there was no money left for any repairs. We effectively were a country that were pretty much on our knees. Across the Atlantic, of course, the United States was booming. It was very much the shining beacon of global politics in the 20th century. It was swallowing up overseas markets in an attempt to actually support its own massive spending. It was very much an outward-looking United States of America. Again, interesting in terms of recent developments from that point of view, which again we'll talk about in seminars. But on a number of levels, it was very difficult for Europe to even begin to think of competing with the free market economy of the United States. That was very much the dominant ideology, not only in terms of Hollywood, in terms of the Dream Factory, but in terms of goods, services, and so on. Britain itself, as epitomised by Winston there, was still a superpower. Although, as we'll see, Winston Churchill was unceremoniously kicked out of office in the first election after the Second World War. But Britain as a country had huge prestige. And it also had a military presence in over 40 countries. It had the presence, but it didn't have the money to back it up. Hence, a special relationship. This term that we've heard bandied about from Tony Blair and George Bush to Donald Trump and Margaret, blessed incumbent present, saying Margaret, it's not Margaret, Theresa May, there we are, Theresa May, from Margaret Thatcher to Ronald Reagan, the special relationship between the two countries, really begins to emerge quite clearly at this particular time. And like all special relationships, it was based on a kind of imbalance. The United States was lending huge amounts of money simply to prop up the British economy. In fact, it wasn't until probably about 6 or 7 years ago that the debt that Britain actually owed America for the United States was finally paid off in full. That's one heck of a student overdraft. Inevitably, the payback for the United States was support. They pretty much insisted and got unequivocal support on all foreign policy issues. So anything the United States wanted to do in terms of global politics, and as we'll see moving into the 1960s with Vietnam and so on, usually met with tacit approval from Britain. This relationship with America was inevitably going to have a huge impact on British culture. And it was also going to prove a key driving force behind youth culture. We see in this particular period, shortly after the war, the growth of that marketing phenomenon, the teenager, and how that also develops and impacts in terms of culture and so on. The baby boomers develop. It's fair to say that the glow of victory after the Second World War probably masked for most people, certainly those people within the population, your grandparents and so on, how weak and dependent on the United States Britain had actually become. Many folk look back to the Second World War with a sense of pride, a sense of nostalgia. The country itself had pulled together. It had stood alone through the darkest hours, and it had proved its worth. Never have so many fought for so few. All the so few fought for so many, we shall fight them on the beaches. All the Churchillian inspirational tones that we still see echoed in mass media comments today. Winston Churchill himself actually gathered a team of historians to write a history of the Second World War, for which he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1956. And while it does arguably massage some of the facts, admittedly history is often rewritten in favour of the victors, it was a bestseller and it helps to reinforce the image of wartime courage and morality that people generally will look upon as being representative of the British character. And people were constantly being reminded of the war through books, through films, through characters in comic magazines, through toys, through television documentaries. Television begins to emerge as a mass media form immediately after the Second World War. And all of these interconnect to weave a mythical story, a war of heroes, a people's war, and so on. Okay, so much for the storyline that we're expected to feed into. But for those growing up in the 1950s, this nostalgia, this looking back at the glory days of the British Empire and so on, was actually becoming quite stifling. It was becoming quite dull. And in any case, the post-war world, with the ensuing Cold War and the nuclear threat, the onset of the atomic age, actually gave all people a very different take on the world. This was an era in which suddenly, with the advent of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you could have the nuclear option. You had mutually assured destruction between the ideologies of the Union of the Soviet Socialist Republics and the United States of America, and Britain somehow caught in the middle of the whole aspect. The clash of mainstream culture and counterculture in the 1960s probably actually owes something of a reaction by the young against this romanticising of the Second World War and also its consequences. As I mentioned earlier, one of the most interesting election results, apart from present recent times, Brexit and United States election, was the immediate British election after the Second World War, in which Churchill
was told, thank you very much, but you've done a good job, off you go. And the Conservative Party were voted out of office, and the Labour Party were voted in. Why? Well, after the war in 1945, it was generally regarded that the British people wanted some kind of payback for their wartime efforts. The government, admittedly a coalition government, had kept morale reasonably high throughout with promises of a better world, this New Jerusalem. And expectations were therefore high that whether it was broke or not, the government could actually deliver. The Labour Party in particular promised jobs, housing, a national health service, and other public services. And accordingly, they won a landslide victory in 1945 with a majority of 146 seats in Parliament. And as we see in terms of Time magazine's cover there, featuring Clement Attlee, the new Prime Minister, he was very much focusing on this notion of, on the one hand, the mythology of the lion rampart, the monarchy is actually there, but Labour's Clement Attlee there. And Attlee himself went through a range of legislative programmes. It was pretty groundbreaking stuff. The key numbers are actually listed up there. The National Insurance Act, paving the way for the creation of the National Health Service. This collective health care for all, this uniformity, that again, arguably still is romanticised to a point. Again, people often talk about it as being one of the jewels in the crown of our particular experience. And the National Assistance Act of 1948 actually created the welfare state, or at least the framework for the welfare state, which meant that there wasn't going to be a case where people would be allowed to slip through the cracks. Or at least that was the intention. The fuel systems, the power systems, electricity and gas, the transport systems, British Rail and bus services and so on, and the Bank of England were all nationalised with the intention of creating full employment. So we shifted from a predominantly private sector-based economy to one which was very much state-operated, state-led, and so on. The one challenge with all of these wonderful ideas was that, unfortunately, the books didn't balance economically. And Britain continued to import more goods than she exported. It's a simple equation. We don't have to be economics majors to appreciate that if you're actually buying more than you're selling, somewhere along the lines, you're going to be in debt and deficit. And that led to a major currency crisis in 1947, just 2 years after the end of the Second World War. Sterling, the pound sterling, was devalued in 1949, which also meant higher prices and public spending cuts. And the R word, which emerged in the war, rationing, was still in place. There's a wonderful book called Eggs or Anarchy that was written by William Sitwell last year, published, which focuses on the whole notion of wartime rationing and how Lord Wolfton effectively had to address the issue of rationing. But rationing didn't end with the end of the Second World War. It stayed in place pretty much until the mid-1950s. People could actually go to the cinema, and you could admire the clothes that were being worn, and you could admire the fridges and the lifestyle of the booming United States, because certainly a lot of their media product was being beamed to us. But whilst you could actually admire the lifestyle, a bit like a child pressed up against a sweet shop window, you couldn't actually have any of it because you couldn't afford it. This inevitably for Britain was an age of austerity. An age of austerity and a population who had denied themselves pretty much everything during the war to get through the war needed to manage on even less. The government actually set limits on what manufacturers were allowed to sell at home so that they could concentrate on exports. So even if you were one of the fortunate families who effectively were in work and could actually sort of afford a car or a washing machine, you still actually had to put your name on a list to actually wait to receive it. This notion of actually going and saying, I have that one, that was not going to be there at all. All of that was very damaging for the Labour government, who quickly lost both the middle class vote and the women's vote. And the government itself struggled from 1947 to 1951 with a much smaller majority. And finally, In 1951, they were pushed out of office for another 13 years. The last initiative of the Labour post-war government actually emerged in 1951, with what, again, arguably could be tied in with its parallel at the turn of this century, the Millennium Dome and the Millennium Capital of London. This was the Festival of Britain. It was a Festival of Britain that was actually based on the South Bank in London, and you can actually just probably make out some sort of London skyline there, the notion of where the dome was actually based within that on the South Bank of the Thames. What was it there for? Well, it was intended to bring tourists. It was intended to increase morale at home, to actually say we can be great again, we can work our way through that. And it was also intended to be a showcase for developments in science, in technology, in the arts, in industrial design, and so on. It actually ran for 5 months in 1951 and was seen very much as a demonstration that Britain was getting back on her feet. Now, admittedly, it was very successful. 8 million visitors actually came to actually see the events, and also there were events that were held all over the country as part of the festival. Again, a lot of echoes here in what Tony Blair established with respect to the Millennium Dome and so on at the start of this century. The high point itself was the opening of the Royal Festival Hall, which had a programme of specially commissioned English music. But in addition to that, you also had areas such as Battersea Park, which had a whole range of pleasure gardens that were developed and put forward. They offered fairground rides to the less discerning, the less culture vultured among the whole sort of people. So there were lots of things that were taking place there, and lots of things for people to do. Inevitably, it being Britain, the event had its critics. It actually cost £11 million, which was a huge amount in the circumstances. Again, a country in debt, in austerity. Can we afford £11 million to have a festival where people are just having fun? It also put so much pressure on London's power supply that some parts of the capital were plunged into darkness. And the pleasure gardens themselves that we see there were opened late because of sort of go-slows, work-to-rules by construction workers who understandably wanted higher rates of pay. When the Conservatives came back in, the festival was shut down in October 1951, and it was basically left the area itself to fall to pieces for a decade. And the main site of the festival on the South Bank was then used for an office block and a car park. The slide that you can see up there is the only building that remains to remind us of the Festival of Britain 1951. It's the Royal Festival Hall. And it's really interesting, if you look at that slide, to compare this building here with its austere, stark, concrete block things, almost like the student accommodation they're building across the way there, with the more ornate, Gothic and intricate structure of the Houses of Westminster, the Houses of Parliament, that we actually see there. Big changes from that perspective. That Royal Festival Hall building is seen as a classic, modern, austere, concrete, brutalist, a symbol perhaps of the New World Order. Now, the Tories had actually promised prosperity for all, and also they promised to cut bureaucracy. But actually, even in the 1950s, it would take them 10 years to achieve the free market consumer paradise that middle-class Americans were enjoying. Not as we'll see that that was necessarily a paradise without its flaws and challenges, but that's an ideological discussion for seminars and so on. In the meantime, rationing continued until 1954, with lots of Spam on the menu. Children would play on bomb sites. Families would struggle to cope with inadequate housing, and life would be dull and boring for most. But, plus side, at least there's no war, you're not likely to be taken off to a concentration camp, you're not likely to be bombed on a regular basis, and life actually was actually secure with plenty of jobs. There was healthcare, there were pensions. Okay, 700,000 homes had been lost during the war years, two most bombed parts of Britain, London and Hull. Hull actually had more TNT dropped on it in Kingston upon Hull than London. But then again, London being in the south obviously suffers a lot more. Sorry, only kidding. But still, in terms of that area, you do have that balance. A lot of the areas, places like Sunderland, Liverpool, ports, etc., had been literally always bombed out of existence in many ways. Initially, the Tories, again under Winston Churchill, who's back in power at this stage, at first proved very successful at replacing the homes that were lost. Now, it's fair to say that the Conservative government as well could be criticised at the time for ignoring other problems, other challenges that we'll see also impact as this module develops. Things like immigration controls, trade union legislation, welfare, education. But the one thing that they were good at was building houses. And by 1953, significant because obviously we're just about to enter the second Elizabethan age there with the coronation of Queen Elizabeth, they were building 300,000 new homes on an annual basis. This, as you can see, is the plan for the first, again, of an ongoing series of garden cities. I mean, Welland being a sort of pre-war example, Milton Keynes being a classic case in point of ensuring that you're building a whole new series of urban environments for people to live in and so on. It's fair to say, though, that quality would often suffer in the drive for quantity. The 1950s to 1960s would see an unprecedented building boom. It would change the way the country looked. It would change the way that people lived. We would have new towns. We would have new housing. We'd have high-rises. We'd have unprecedented demolition. So the stuff which hadn't been demolished by the bombing would actually be effectively demolished by a whole range of clearance programmes. So what was the point of this? What were the purposes? Let's ask that classic question when I say analysis. Why? Why was this happening? Well, primarily two reasons. First of all, there was a need for homes, but there was also a need to accommodate rising traffic. This shot here of Euston at the turn of the century with the official gateway to the north in an era where the horse-drawn carriage is very much part of the fabric of London life. It's seen as the heart of empire and so on. Was also a way which had to change. Again, traffic was changing. The second key reason is it also was a money earner. The more houses and homes you've got, the more you can establish councils to increase rates, increase local taxes, and so on and so forth. Now, some folk would actually say that this clearance programme, this mass building programme of the 1950s and 60s and onwards, was simply slum clearance. Others would say it was licensed vandalism, as local authorities and developers weren't actually very concerned about what they actually pulled down. So, to consider that, there's the gateway to the north as was, there's as it became, as it sort of tended to recognise from that. So, as was, as is. Which one do you like? Euston Station and Arch was demolished in 1963. There was a huge protest about the demolition of the old arch, that gateway to the north that was actually there. And in fact, between 1959 and 1975, listed buildings were demolished at the rate of one a day, mostly for new roads. So again, you're building a lot of stuff there. Is it working? Is it important? Does it connect? Does it prepare us for life in the 20th century? There's the Birmingham Bullring, set in the 1930s, as we could see from that point of view. That's immediately after the Second World War, and then we're on to that, the Bullring Centre and life of that. So, before and after. This may be simply personal taste, it may be critical views, it may be perspective, it may be an inevitable aspect and reluctance to engage in change and so on. But there was still this sense of criticism that somehow this was brutalism. This was a new concrete architecture. This was something which was about austerity. More and more housing was being built for less and less standards. A whole range of things were actually up there, and you're just getting, let's build, let's move from that point of view. And the communities that these houses came up in, these buildings emerged from, etc., may well have actually gained roads, schools, new community amenities. But they've lost a sense. They've lost a sense of community. They've lost a sense of identity. There's almost a feeling that this modernisation, this drive to all sorts of other areas, this Gateshead car park actually is featured in the original movie Get Carter, amongst other things, and became a listed building as a result of that. But in terms of that, we lost that sense of community and identity, and modernisation was creating this appearance of desolation, which was actually just as bad as the bombed-out cities we talked about. And again, it's no surprise that as we see in the latter part of the 20th century, a lot of community groups have problems living in high-rise environments, flats and so on and so forth, which raise that sort of issue. Again, interesting statistic, between 1950 and 1975, the growth of motorways consumed over 25,000 acres of agricultural land. Now, in a country that was very much prided on this green and pleasant land and so on, to suddenly actually be concreted over, tarmac, etc., that would be key issues with respect to that. Even more so when in 1963 the Beeching Report effectively recommended that 5,000 railway stations should be taken out of the system because more and more people will be using roads and cars to travel on. That effectively left 2,500 working railway stations. So, you know, 5,000 stations actually gone, 3,000 miles of railway track were abandoned, which gave you 20,000 acres of derelict land. An infrastructure which we now look back on and say, why can't we have a decent public transport? Why can't we have more trains to Lincoln going through and for the whole thing? Well, go back to 1963, that's when all the railway stations were effectively shut down, the tracks were demolished and so on, from what was referred to as the Beeching Acts. There was a huge range of derelict landscapes of Victorian factories and yards, and this particular instance of building too soon without sufficient substantive materials led to a whole range of potential collapses. Again, the Roland Point collapse in 68, primarily due to poor building work and poor construction that was actually put into place within that. And again, in terms of the local rural economy, between 1947 and 1980, half of the woods in England were effectively destroyed. So, we're building, we're doing a lot of building stuff, and we're building a lot of material from that point of view. But there's still this strong feeling of decline. There's still a strong feeling that these housing initiatives are somehow failing. There's a failure in the inner cities. There's a failure with respect to urban life that comes through. We still have large areas that are derelicts, that aren't actually working. You're getting a kind of mixture, a kind of patchwork quilt of input in terms of what is developing. And we have this notion that there's a cultural disconnection within the new towns and the new estates. Ultimately, people will have a wave of a nostalgia for the past. Communities would campaign to save their buildings, to work through a range of other aspects, and to actually argue that areas of natural beauty, the green belt around towns, etc., should be established and protected against developers and brutalist architects. But again, those are areas we'll kind of come back to in terms of the infrastructure and the kind of architectural elements of Britain. Ultimately, in the 1950s, if you ask the ordinary people in the street, what did they want? They wanted housing, and housing was what they got. In 1953, Winston Churchill suffered a stroke. He struggled on until 1955 as Prime Minister, with the press pretty much playing down the gravity of his ill health. But after 6 months, he was declared unfit for office, and he retired in 1955, being replaced by this gentleman, Anthony Eden. Eden was a great statesman. He'd been there, he bought the T-shirt, or equivalent, effectively knew the material on the world stage. He had a wartime reputation, because he'd served as Foreign Secretary in the Second World War. He had one or two health problems, but because they were building lots of stuff and standard of living was rising slowly but surely, the Conservatives remained as popular as ever until a critical point emerged. It was the Suez Crisis, of 1956. Now, the Suez Crisis, you see there the cover of Time magazine, which a gentleman will talk about in a few moments, was one of the most important and controversial events in modern British history. Not only did the crisis actually result in deep political and public divisions in Britain, it also caused international uproar. So what was it about, this thing which you might have loosely heard about? Why was it, such a radical key point to be discussed and debated, you know, even in the second decade of the 21st century? Well, Egypt, in the 20th century, up until 1956, was a British protectorate. It had gained independence in 1936, but British troops still remained in Egypt to protect vital interests. In 1954, the gentleman we can see there in Time magazine, once again, General Gamal Nasser, became president of Egypt. Nasser was an influential moderniser. He was a nationalist. He was also the first president of the United Arab Republic. So, what irritated Nasser to the extent that he decided to take on board the might of the then British Empire? Well, the British and American governments had reneged on an agreement to help fund the Aswan Dam project in Egypt, partly because they couldn't afford it, and partly because Egypt was actually buying arms from the Soviet Union, which they suspected were being used against Israel, or meant for being used against Israel. So you're seeing the geopolitical structure coming through here, the advent of what, as we'll see, became proxy wars and developments within that. Colonel Nasser responded to the loss of funding by nationalising the Suez Canal. The Suez Canal was a canal that effectively was relied upon by both Britain and France for oil supplies. After a lot of international discussion, with obviously the United States, Britain and France decided to go it alone. And these two former enemies decided, with the backing of Israel, to invade Egypt. Take back through force the canal. Result, disaster. Anthony Eden was actually trying to present himself as a defender of the British Empire. But the United Nations condemned the action. And the United States, alarmed by the rise in European aggression and what looked like, again, the old imperialistic outlook, threatens to create a currency crisis by obviously claiming back all the debts immediately, foreclosing on the loans and so on. Thousands of people gathered to protest in Trafalgar Square. Anthony Eden was forced to back down and withdraw his troops, and Britain, unfortunately, was humiliated. Again, echoes of what we see here in sort of Iraq and Iran, Syria and so on. Law, not war, is the banner headline from that perspective. Daily Herald sort of connection from that point of view. And Life magazine, which again we have a whole range of Life magazines over in the library, which just always gives you a snapshot into photographic history of the era and the period, wrap up of the astounding war. We caught a bounce there, an Israeli soldier cooling off in the Suez Canal. What impact did this actually have, this kind of critical geopolitical sort of aspect? Well, it actually meant, and it's often regarded as, the end of Britain's role as one of the world powers. It was the beginning of the end of the British Empire, as was understood, the empire in which the sun never sets, and so on. The operation primarily reveals just how weak Britain had become. Egypt, for goodness sake. It's like, you know, it's like losing to Lincoln City in the FA Cup. It's a disaster if you're a Premiership side. It's just appalling. How can we cope with that? You know, ultimately it's got to that whole system where suddenly Britain is seen as a very weak international statesman. It lost any real moral authority to intervene in world affairs. Because how can you actually have the moral authority to criticise any human abuses in another country if you're using your own bullying tactics to invade tiny little Egypt just because they might, you know, they've nationalised the Suez Canal and they might be selling one or two arms or buying a few arms from Russia? You know, surely, it's a problem. It was also seen as immoral because it had been backed, basically, you know, you're backing this Arab state against Israel, and clearly a lot of concern with Israel, a very newly established state in the advent of the Second World War, a lot of issues with respect to the issues relating to Israel and so on. And ultimately, even worse, take all of those, you're acting like a bully, you're marching into this little protectorate, you're exercising your force, etc. It lost, you know, Britain had to withdraw. France effectively kind of stepped in, stepped out again. Standard. But in terms of that, it was a problem. And the morale that was actually set up in terms of the last 10 years after the Second World War was shattered. Result, in the future, pretty much until the present day, all British foreign policy had to be agreed with support from the American diplomacy division. If America wasn't in agreement, forget it. Don't move at all. Big problem. Anthony Eden is Prime Minister by now, 1956 and so on, either ill or exhausted. And he actually took advantage of an invitation to recuperate in Jamaica, staying at the house of a certain Ian Fleming, the creator of James Bond. Really significant in terms of the cultural impact that we see shifting in terms of the position of Britain in the world. And on Anthony Eden's return in 1957, which actually had press headlines such as Prime Minister Visits, he resigned from office. His successor was Harold Macmillan, and he tried to set a more cheerful note. Macmillan's line was Britain had never had it so good. And actually, take out the Suez crisis, take out the geopolitical sense of things, you could create an argument for saying that actually had some element of truth in it. Britain at the end of the 50s was a crowded, urbanised society. 80% of people lived in cities, but the economy was booming and unemployment was low. Wages were rising. Consumption was rising, fuelled by the dream, the capitalist dream, that actually, if you feel low, go out and buy stuff. If you still feel miserable, buy more stuff. It's great. It'll help you along the way. People generally were healthier. National Health Service was obviously in place. They were better educated. They were better housed, despite some of the problems with respect to some of the flats and areas that we sort of saw. And cars and domestic appliances like fridge, cookers, vacuum cleaners and so on were actually easily available. Fashion was also becoming available and so on. And you were getting a gradual notion of the teenager establishing itself. In other words, this American dream, it's important to notice it's an American dream, of self-fulfillment through consumption had finally arrived. This particular photograph, which features President Kennedy and Harold Macmillan there, actually outside the White House, is very significant in a number of ways. We'll talk about it a bit more in terms of seminar discussions, but it's often hailed in terms of the shot composition of the new dynamic American young president pointing the way to the elder statesman of where Britain's perceived, etc., and looking with the backdrop of huge columns, colonnades, and you know, the authenticity of power, all the trappings of power, including the military chap at the back there, of where the future actually is pointing. And it's a future in which Britain is no longer leading, but arguably is following. Next week, the rise of youth culture and that appearance of that phenomenon called the teenager. Look forward to seeing you then, and indeed in seminars next week. Bye for now. And make sure you sign the register as well. Thanks.